Chapter 6. Rebuilding the Living World. Death from exposure to the Ebola virus is excruciating. First, you feel extremely weak with flu-like symptoms as the virus starts infecting and then bursting your cells and blood vessels. You then experience uncontrolled nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and headaches. Your cells hemorrhage, causing uncontrolled bleeding throughout your body. You then go into shock before you die a gruesome, bloody death, your vital fluids bursting out from every orifice of your body. Early Ebola outbreaks in the poorest parts of Africa saw death rates of up to 90% of those infected. The somewhat better health care provided during the 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa reduced the death rate to around 60%. The people most likely to be infected by Ebola are the family members and health care providers caring for loved ones and patients already infected. Just being exposed to the saliva, vomit, urine, or stool of an Ebola victim is enough. But scientists who studied survivors of the 2014 Ebola outbreak in Guinea were surprised to come across a group of caretaker women who had been exposed but somehow seemed immune to the disease. Some of these women had contracted the virus at an earlier point and survived, possibly giving them immunity to later exposures. Others, however, possessed antibodies even though they hadn't been exposed. What was happening? The scientists wondered. Could some of these women be genetically immune to Ebola? Researchers zeroed in on a gene that encodes a protein called Niemann-Pick type C, or NPC, which the Ebola virus targets when attacking a host. Having nothing to do with Ebola, children inheriting two copies from their parents of the mutated version of this gene generally die from Niemann-Pick type C disease, a neurodegenerative disorder. Some single-gene diseases like Huntington's disease and Marfan syndrome are dominant, which means that you'll almost certainly get the disease if you inherit the gene and either of your parents is homozygous for the mutation. Others, like with sickle cell disease, Tay-Sachs, and Niemann-Pick type C disease, are recessive disorders, which means you only get the disease if you inherit the gene from both parents. But, just like recessive carriers of the sickle cell disease gene can have immunity from malaria, preliminary studies of these West African women suggested that people with only one mutated copy of the NPC gene may have increased resistance to the Ebola virus. We've already explored single gene and other mutations that can cause disease, but just as there are some individual genetic mutations that can inflict harm, there are many more single gene mutations that can do good. As the Ebola case shows, sometimes these can be the same genes that help us in one context but hurt us in another. Over the past decade, scientists have been searching to find more of the single gene mutations with outsized potentials to help us, at least in the context of the world we know today. Finding them, however, is a challenge. It's much easier to identify an illness that presents itself with observable symptoms than to identify the absence of a disease among people who, but for a particular genetic mutation, might otherwise have it. But by finding outliers, like the women with Ebola immunity, and poring through databases of hundreds of thousands, or even millions of genomes and health records to find correlations between the presence of a rare variant gene and resistance to specific diseases, researchers are increasingly striking gold. David Altshuler, for example, while a researcher at the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT, recruited a cohort of elderly and overweight people who were statistically at a high risk of developing type 2 diabetes but hadn't. After sequencing the members of the group to see how they might be genetically different from other people with the disease who were equally old and overweight, he came to believe that a single mutation in the SLC30A8 gene made his cohort 65% better able to regulate their insulin levels and less likely to get diabetes. Another study found that 1% of Northern Europeans carried a mutation in their CCR5 gene that makes them immune to HIV infection. Another elderly study found that about 1 in 650 people with mutations of their NPC1L1 gene had less than half the risk of a heart attack compared to people just like them but without the mutation. Because making small changes to the human genome is easier and safer than making big ones, identifying single gene mutations with significant potential positive impact raises the enticing possibility of gene editing these small mutations into ourselves or future children. Because our biology represents a delicate balancing act of priorities played out over billions of years, only a tiny number of genes are likely to have an impact large enough to make the benefit of adding or removing them outweigh the potential danger of making a change. But, as the Ebola and other cases point out, it's definitely worthwhile to look for them. According to Harvard's George Church, a preliminary list of these rare single genes that could potentially be manipulated to give us special benefits might include gene LRP5, impact extra strong bones, gene MSTN, impact lean muscles, gene SCN9A, impact insensitivity to pain, gene ABCC11, impact low odor production, genes CCR5 and FUT2, impact virus resistance, gene PCSK9, impact low coronary disease, gene APP, impact low Alzheimer's, genes GHR and GH, impact low cancer, gene SLC30A8, impact low type 2 diabetes, gene IFIH1, impact low type 1 diabetes. Making small changes to genes like these isn't our only path to effect these changes. Genes, as we've learned, are a set of instructions telling cells to make proteins that do things. Although it matters what the genes say, what the cells actually do is ultimately what's important. So, even if we find a particular gene that does something we feel is good or bad, we wouldn't necessarily need to change the gene in order to change its expression. In some cases, it might make more sense and be safer, easier, and cheaper to develop drugs that instruct the cells to do what we want, even if the bad mutation remains or the good mutation is never there. Even so, there will be some mutations, both cumulatively helpful and hurtful ones, where this type of treatment will not be possible. Like with mitochondrial disease, there might be a mutation that is seen as so harmful that some carriers would want to get rid of it for all future generations. Some parents might want to alter the germline of their future children to make them immune to HIV, less likely to face cognitive decline as they age, or benefit from any other single gene mutation that confers a special advantage. When considering the possibility of having one or a small number of single gene edits made to their pre-implanted embryos, the first question parents will ask is whether this is safe. At present, the answer is no. CRISPR is still not a perfect technology. One of the largest concerns about the first generation of CRISPR gene editing tools was their potential to cut the genome in places other than where the scientists intended. This type of off-target cutting has shown up most significantly in the gene editing of human cells. An important 2013 study examined off-target CRISPR edits in human cells and found that CRISPR edits for therapeutic applications would need to be significantly improved to be used safely in the longer term for treatment of human diseases. If these types of off-target mutations were always benign, any small change made by CRISPR editing human genes inside a person wouldn't amount to much. But that is not the case. A CRISPR-induced mutation could also have the potential to become cancerous. That's why regulators around the world have been justifiably cautious about authorizing the gene editing of humans. The Chinese research group that shocked the world by announcing its CRISPR editing of the non-viable human embryos in 2015, for example, reported abysmal accuracy levels. Of the 86 fertilized eggs injected with the CRISPR-Cas9 system designed to edit their genomes, only a few contained the desired genetic change. This ratio of attempts to successes is acceptable in plant, worm, fly, and mouse models, where the cost of mistakes tends to be lower, but would be unthinkable for humans. The path toward reaching a level of reliability, where CRISPR could be safely used inside humans, will not be linear. A high-profile 2018 study, for example, found that a single human gene, P53, blocked CRISPR edits in some human cells as part of the body's natural defense mechanism against dangerous mutations like cancer. One way around this would be to deactivate the P53 gene, but this would bring a new danger, increased cancer risk. Another 2018 study published in Nature Biotechnology found 20% more off-target DNA alterations than previously expected when making CRISPR-Cas9 edits in mice. Scientists intent on addressing such concerns have focused on increasing the accuracy of CRISPR gene editing, with some dramatic success. They are discovering new enzymes that more precisely attach to or break the genome than CRISPR-Cas9. These new CRISPRs, with names like CRISPR-CPF1, aka 12A, CRISPR-Cas3, CRISPR-13, CRISPR-Cas-X, and CRISPR-Cas-Y, are proliferating. New AI algorithms are also being deployed to assess where CRISPR edits can most optimally be made. In 2017, researchers reported a new method for changing DNA and RNA nucleotide letters, the A's, C's, G's, and T's, without cutting the genome. The original CRISPR model required cutting across the twisting ladder of DNA. The modified process changes the genes without cutting the ladder at all. To do this, researchers tricked the DNA atoms to pair differently than they otherwise would. Remember that A's pair with T's and C's with G's, so if the cell thinks an A is a C, for example, it will pair it with a G rather than a T. The gene and its expression change, but the uncertainty that arises from cutting DNA is avoided. This approach is particularly useful because an estimated 32,000 of the roughly 50,000 known changes in the human genome associated with diseases are caused by the swapping, deletion, or insertion of a single gene. Called an adenine base editor, or ABE, this new version of CRISPR works 34-68% of the time, with less than 0.1% of cells showing evidence of additional mistakes, a big improvement, but still not ready to be deployed inside a human body. Chinese researchers reported in August 2018 that they had base-edited the genomes to repair a mutation causing Marfan syndrome in 16 out of 18 viable pre-implanted human embryos. Although none of these embryos were implanted due to legal and ethical considerations, it is clear where this technology is headed. Base editing technology was then used to increase the precision and potentially the safety of gene editing even further through a process called CRISPR-skip. Editing a single base with this approach causes the cell to skip over and not read targeted strings of protein-coding genes. Preliminary indications suggest CRISPR-skip could be used to deactivate damage-causing mutations in the genome with far fewer off-target effects than many of the other CRISPR systems. In addition to using CRISPR for gene editing, significant progress is also being made using CRISPR to edit the epigenetic marks orchestrating how genes function and the RNA guides that translate the genetic information into instructions for the cell. Together, these approaches will make altering genes and their expression more precise. Another big challenge to overcome to make the gene editing of pre-implanted human embryos safe is the uneven spread of a genetic change across the cells, which scientists call mosaicism. Uneven distribution of a gene-edited mutation can lead to abnormal growth of the fetus and other serious problems. But this challenge, too, is being gradually addressed. Recent studies have shown that using CRISPR as soon as possible after fertilization and editing the sperm and egg cells prior to fertilization decrease the chances that cell mosaicism will occur. After Shukrat Metalipov and his team announced their new approaches for minimizing this potential problem, another group of superstar geneticists issued a statement the following month raising questions about the accuracy of this research. It is essential that conclusions regarding the ability to correct a mutation in human embryos be fully supported, Dieter Egli, George Church, and their colleagues wrote in a joint statement, arguing that Metalipov's conclusions were far from proven. Absent such data, the biomedical community, and, critically, patients with disease-causing mutations interested in such research, must be made aware that numerous challenges in gene correction remain. This debate among leading genetics researchers then ramped up a notch in August 2018, when Nature published, in the same issue, two scathing critiques of Metalipov's research, as well as a long and detailed response from Metalipov and 31 of his colleagues from around the world. Although all scientists would agree that our ability to precisely edit pre-implanted human embryos is increasing, the debate is still raging about whether we are ready yet to use these technologies on human embryos intended to be implanted in a mother and taken to term. But, once again, the operative word in this last sentence is yet. If logic were our guide, people would start getting more comfortable with gene editing embryos once the error rate in gene editing matched the error rate of natural conception. As we've seen from the experience of self-driving cars, however, the reality is that a new technology like this needs to be much safer than nature for it to be adopted. At least for the technical process of making a very limited number of genome edits, this standard will soon be reached. If and when this happens, gene editing pre-implanted embryos and eggs and/or sperm may be the only way for some parents carrying a subset of genetic disorders to have a biologically related child who would not inherit the disorder. These instances would include some Y-chromosome defects, dominant monogenetic diseases like Huntington's, where one parent is homozygous, and recessive conditions where both parents are homozygous. An extremely controversial first use of CRISPR to allegedly edit a single gene, CCR5, in the pre-implanted embryos of a pair of twins to make them immune to HIV was announced by Chinese researchers in late November 2018. Although roundly condemned by many scientists and ethicists in China and around the world, this first-ever case of gene-editing humans was a harbinger of where our genetically engineered future is heading. But while increasing confidence with the use of IVF, embryo selection, and single gene editing of pre-implanted embryos seems all but inevitable, the prospect of editing more complex genetic traits remains significantly more remote. As we've seen, complex traits like height, intelligence, and personality are most often determined by the complex interaction of hundreds or even thousands of genes, all performing multiple functions and interacting with other body systems and the constantly changing environment around us. A group of Stanford researchers recently argued that most genetic diseases and traits are not just polygenic, influenced by multiple genes, but instead what they call omnigenic. This hypothesis argues that traits are influenced not just by the systemic contribution of the many core genes, the ones that now show up on genome-wide association studies, but also by a much larger network of peripheral genes that don't. If true, this would make understanding complex diseases and traits far more complicated than previously imagined. The more genes that influence a particular trait, the more difficult a computational task it becomes to fully understand the correlation between genetic patterns and certain gene expressions. The harder it is to understand the multiple functions each gene performs in the complex and interconnected ecosystem of the genome, the tougher it becomes to make bigger gene edits intending to influence complex traits without unintentionally damaging the rest of the genome. It certainly should be our assumption that the interconnected ecosystems of the human body are almost always more complex than we tend to think they are. It also makes logical sense that our diseases and traits span a wide range of genetic foundations, from the single gene mutation diseases like Huntington's and single gene determined traits like having wet earwax on the one hand, to complex diseases and traits like coronary heart disease and personality style on the other. The omnigenic model may be a worst-case scenario for aspiring genetic engineers that, even if true in some instances, certainly won't apply equally to all diseases and traits. But we won't need anything even approaching an omnigenic level of understanding when people are selecting from among their own natural and unedited pre-implanted embryos during IVF and PGT. The steady increase in our understanding of complex genetic patterns, even omnigenic ones, will be enough to inform moderately educated guesses by parents about which embryos to implant in the mother. As our imperfect knowledge of these complex traits increases, so will our confidence in selecting and ultimately genetically altering our future children. To many religious people and others who believe in the concepts of the spirit and soul, a human being is infinitely complex. For these people, even the most accurate medical tests cannot unlock the mysteries of the spiritual world or the deep interaction between humans and the divine. For those like me, who believe we evolved from microbes, humans are single-cell organisms gone wild over 600 million years of random mutation and natural selection. We are not infinitely complex beings, just massively complex ones. There's a big difference. If we are infinitely complex, we'll never understand ourselves. If we're only massively complex, there will come a time when the sophistication of our tools will outmatch our own complexity. We can understand simple organisms pretty well today because our advanced tools are increasingly a match for the complexity of their biology. Human biology, however, remains significantly more complex than our understanding of, or tools to manipulate, it. This won't always be the case. As our knowledge and tools progress, our complexity will become as understandable with our tools of tomorrow as simple organisms have already become with our tools of today. To get a glimpse of how it will feel when the sophistication of our knowledge and tools begins to surpass the complexity of our biology and what that might mean, we only need to look at how quickly our understanding of single cell and other simple organisms has grown. The C. elegans roundworm is the perfect example. Smaller at maturity than the size of a comma on a page, the standard mature C. elegans goes from birth to death in about 2 weeks, has a rudimentary nervous system with a brain, reproduces exponentially, and is probably the simplest living organism that shares many of its genes with humans. These qualities, along with its transparent and easily observable body, makes these little creatures perfect research subjects and among the most studied model organisms in science. Over past decades, researchers have starved, chilled, and heated C. elegans as they look for the outliers. They have probed the roundworms with advanced microscopes, spun them around wildly in centrifuges, exposed them to antibodies, tagged them with laser microbeams to eliminate individual cells, profiled their proteins, and isolated and amplified their individual genes for closer examination. In 2011, a group of ambitious scientists came together to create the Open Worm Project designed to network C. elegans researchers from around the world in a common effort to crack the code of how the C. elegans functions. The C. elegans has exactly 302 brain cells, compared to about 100 billion for us, unless you did drugs in college or drink diet soda, that have been mapped in a connectome, a diagram of the switchboard of connections showing the worm's brain at work. As an early step toward completely simulating the C. elegans as a virtual entity, the Open Worm collaborators translated its neurons into a computer program used to animate a small robot, where the worm's motor neurons, nose, and other body parts all had robotic equivalents. When booted up, the robot's movements tracked those of an actual roundworm with surprising consistency. We have moved from little to deep understanding of how the roundworms function in the past few decades, because the growing sophistication of our tools has enabled the growing sophistication of our knowledge. Getting from where we are now in our understanding of our own biology to the point where we will be the equivalent of the C. elegans relative to the sophistication of our knowledge and tools will require a map that is just starting to be built. The Human Cell Atlas is an open coordination platform that integrates data on human biology from around the world. This collection of comprehensive reference maps of all human cells will grow over time as research tools become more powerful and as researchers' knowledge compounds. In these early days, the magnitude of the body's complexity will tower over the capacity of our still relatively humble tools and our current limited knowledge. But why this will change can most clearly be explained later. Our biology is about as complex as it has been for millions of years, but the sophistication and capacity of our tools is now advancing at exponential rates. The basic idea of exponential change is that innovation begets innovation. The more and better tools we develop, the more efficiently and effectively we organize ourselves and connect with each other, and the more ideas we have, the better positioned we are to devise even better tools, organize and connect more, and come up with even greater ideas. That's why it took around 12,000 years to go from the agrarian revolution to the industrial revolution, but only a couple of hundred years to move from the industrial revolution to the internet revolution. Each technological revolution enables the next, and the time between each revolution becomes shorter and the impact bigger. Futurist Ray Kurzweil called this process the law of accelerating returns. In 1999, Kurzweil predicted that the entire amount of technological change achieved in the 20th century would be achieved in only the first 14 years of the 21st century. As innovations compound, he suggested the full 20th century amount of change will take only 7 years starting in 2021. The same 20th century amount of change will take around a year a short while after that time. Ultimately, the equivalent of the full 20th century rate of change, equivalent to going from horse and buggy to the International Space Station, will take only months. Since the invention of the microprocessor in the early 1970s, this acceleration has been fed by Moore's Law, the observation that computing power roughly doubles about every 2 years for the same cost, a trend that has continued for nearly half a century. It's because of Moore's Law that we now expect our smartphones to be lighter and faster with each version, but that's the least of it. The internet revolution has given us virtually unlimited access to information and to each other, and a network of thousands of educated people linked and working together to solve the same series of problems is way more than 1,000 times more creative than the sum total of each of us working alone. Collaborating with artificial intelligence, AI agents, this networked group of people has the potential to be many times more innovative than the 1,000 people merely connected to each other. As AI capacities grow, a future form of superintelligence may become more sophisticated than all humans put together, and new possibilities for remaking our species and our world will emerge. Over time, hard things will become easy, and today's complex things will become, relative to the tools and capacities we have to understand them, simple. Collectively as a species, we are today moving along the spectrum from laying the technological foundation for human genetic engineering to finding preliminary applications to imagining what might be possible in the future to making that imagined future real. Even the legends of our past are strangely becoming our new realities. The idea of humans merging with animals, one of our most ancient human mythologies, is a perfect case in point. The word chimera comes from a Greek word meaning she-goat. In Greek mythology, the chimera was a hybrid of different animals, usually a lion with a goat head and sometimes with a snake tail. In the Iliad, Homer described a thing of immortal make, not human, lion-fronted and snake behind, a goat in the middle. In Dante's Inferno, Geryon represents a medieval version of the chimera, the monster with the pointed tail. The face was as the face of a just man, and of a serpent all the trunk beside. Many ancient cultures shared this idea. The Chinese Qi Lin, a mythical creature with the neck of a giraffe, the antlers of a buck, and the scales of a fish, allegedly marks the birth and death of important rulers. The Indian Ganesh is the son of the gods Shiva and Parvati, with the head of an elephant and the body of a man. More recently, chimeras have come to mean any creature that is composed of parts from multiple plants or animals, a concept that has moved from fiction to fact. Nearly 100 years ago, insulin removed from cows was first used to treat diabetes. Extracted dog, pig, and cow insulin made it possible for humans to live with diabetes and saved countless lives for decades until E. coli bacteria could be genetically modified to produce human insulin at scale. Over 3 decades ago, doctors started using pig and cow valves when repairing human hearts. Although this process was somewhat controversial among some Jews, Muslims, and Hindus, the use of decellularized animal aortic valves has become a mainstay of cardiovascular transplant surgery, even for many Jews, Muslims, and Hindus. The benefits simply outweigh the risks. Scientists have had greater success using animal heart valves for human transplantation than full-organ animal-to-human transplants. In 1984, California surgeon Leonard Bailey and his team famously transplanted a baboon heart into Baby Faye, a child born with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, a rare congenital heart defect. Although a small number of additional animal-to-human transplants have been attempted since, all of them proved unsustainable after being rejected by each person's immune system. But although Baby Faye tragically died within a month, the procedure opened the door to progress in human-to-human organ transplants, which have proven far more sustainable than animal-to-human transplants that saved hundreds of thousands of lives since. These transplants, however, have 2 major problems. First, the human body is fine-tuned to reject alien DNA, so people getting transplants need to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives, which puts them at risk for other ailments. Second, the United States and many other countries face a tragic shortage of donated organs. As of August 2017, there were more than 114,000 people waiting on organ transplant lists across the United States. 20 people die every day while waiting for a transplant. This chronic and deadly organ shortage should, theoretically at least, be solvable with policy changes alone. A single donor can donate as many as 8 organs, meaning that he or she could potentially save up to 8 lives. But that's not what's happening. In the United States, 95% of people support organ donation, but only 54% are registered donors. A far smaller percentage actually ends up donating because family members can be conflicted about organ donation at the emotionally challenging moments when the decisions are made. Because the prospects for getting more humans to donate their organs are still poor in the United States and many parts of the world, scientists have been exploring how new technologies like CRISPR-Cas9 can be used to make animal-to-human organ transplants more feasible. Of all domesticated animals, pigs are the most important potential source for transplants, because we already breed a lot of them, and because their organs are similar in size and function to ours. But harvesting organs from pigs has at least two big problems. The first, the human body's natural immune response, is extremely serious, but has been made more manageable over past decades with both the steady advance of new immunosuppressant drugs and by preliminary efforts to edit the animal genes most likely to be rejected by humans. The second problem, the risk of pig and other animal viruses infecting humans after transplants, is also starting to be overcome. Pigs carry active viruses called porcine endogenous retrovirus, which scientists have given the unfortunate acronym PERV. These viruses can be extremely dangerous and even deadly to humans, particularly those whose immune systems are already suppressed by drugs. Until recently, PERV was essentially a deal killer for pig-to-human transplants. Now, however, a group of Harvard scientists is using CRISPR-Cas9 to edit the genome of pig embryos in multiple locations simultaneously to create pigs with their PERVs rendered inactive. Clinical trials for transplanting gene-edited pig kidneys and pancreases to humans are likely to begin soon, potentially saving thousands of human lives per year. But why stop there? If using insulin made from genetically engineered bacteria and yeast was a step up from using animal insulin, wouldn't transplanting an entire human organ grown outside a person's body from a person's own cells be better than transplanting a gene-edited animal one? What if we could grow human organs inside animals for transplantation? Making this possible would be no easy feat, but a significant first step has been made to produce chimeric embryos generated from cells of one type of animal grown in another. Scientists at San Diego's Salk Institute injected different levels of human stem cells into 1,500 pig embryos until they finally found a human cell that integrated into the pig cells. Another team inserted mouse pancreatic cells into rat embryos that grew into mouse pancreases inside the rats, which were then successfully transplanted back into mice to treat diabetes. This work was then followed up by an announcement in February 2018 that a team from the University of California, Davis had developed sheep embryos with 0.001% human cells. Just like with the rats and mice, hacking the sheep embryo to shut off its ability to grow a particular sheep organ and replace it with inserted human genes, instructing it to instead make a human version of the same organ type, is starting to seem like a real possibility. Growing human organs in other species will not happen tomorrow, but if it becomes possible for an individual person to have an organ grown inside an animal using his or her own genetics, people needing replacement parts because of illness or the ravages of age will quickly overcome any squeamishness they may have about crossing the human-animal barrier. Governments will be hard-pressed to prevent people from having replacement parts grown in animals. The possibility of inserting animal DNA into the human genome imagines a future that science is fast making real. The science already exists to relatively easily place a single fluorescent protein from jellyfish into humans that can make a person glow under UV light. If scientists find a single gene or two that make naked mole rats completely resistant to cancer, for example, might we want to splice versions of that gene into humans using CRISPR or some future gene editing tool? Integrating whole genetic systems like those that give dogs special hearing abilities, eagles amazing vision, or dolphins sonar would be a lot more complicated and not possible anytime soon. But the transition of biology into yet another domain for human engineering will, over time, blur our sense of where science fiction ends and science begins. The possibilities for this type of engineering are vast because all life operates according to different manifestations of the same genetic components. It will someday be possible to even create new human traits and capabilities from scratch, using new combinations of these same genetic building blocks. The exploding field of synthetic biology uses computers and laboratory chemicals to write new genetic code that nature never imagined and make organisms do things they weren't previously programmed to do. Some of its early applications include current efforts to culture meat in a lab, engineer oil-secreting bacteria, manufacture yeast with spider DNA to make ultra-light silk stronger than steel, or induce bovine collagen to make non-animal leather. Synthetic biology is being used to create renewable microbes to produce acrylics for paints and custom engineer inexpensive synthetic sugars for biofuel. The preliminary list of these types of synthetic biology applications is almost endless. This science and the industry associated with it are exploding as synthetic biology tools become more easily accessible. These new life forms are being created from readily accessible genetic parts. The International Genetically Engineered Machine, iGEM, Foundation, for example, provides a free collection of DNA sequences encoding for a particular biological function that can be mixed and matched to build synthetic biology devices and systems. The BioBricks Foundation, established by MIT and Harvard researchers, provides synthetic gene sequences for free, making ordering genetic sequences about as easy for a researcher as dropping by Home Depot is for a builder. The ease, accessibility, and flexibility of these tools are empowering a synthetic biology revolution where all sorts of useful products, including computer chips, appliances, and clothes, could be grown through engineering biology. The commercial implications of this revolution are massive. It is estimated that the global synthetic biology market will grow from around $3 billion in 2013 to about $40 billion in 2020, with a projected global compound annual growth rate of 20%. Not surprisingly, China is expected to be the world's fastest-growing market for synthetic biology products. According to leading biologist Richard Kitney, synthetic biology has all the potential to produce a new major industrial revolution. As the global population rises, our climate continues to heat, and new and unforeseen challenges arise, these types of precision gene editing-based synthetic biology applications will become essential for our survival. Our growing dependence on synthetic biology in our lives will pave the way for greater acceptance of synthetic biology in ourselves. This process, too, has already begun. In 2010, the maverick scientific entrepreneur Craig Venter announced that he and his colleagues had synthesized the full genome of a bacteria called Mycoplasma mycoides and placed it into the empty membrane of another bacteria, creating the world's first synthetic cell. This wasn't just editing an existing cell, like getting a bacterium to produce insulin, but building life from scratch. For people concerned that biologists were playing God, this was Exhibit A. 6 years later, Venter's team announced they had pared down the genetic code of their synthetic cell to a much smaller number of essential genes required to keep it alive. As a first step in a never-ending process of creating and rewriting the code of life, this was a major achievement. Recent leaps in the biosciences, combined with big data analysis, have led us to the cusp of a revolution in medicine, Venter wrote in a December 2017 Washington Post editorial. Not only have we learned to read and write the genetic code, now we can put it in digital form and translate it back into synthesized life. In theory, that gives our species control over biological design. We can write DNA software, boot it up to a computer converter, and create unlimited variations of the gene sequences of biological life. It is a very long way from synthesizing the genome of a single-cell organism, which hasn't yet fully happened, to doing it for the 21,000 or so protein-coding genes in the human genome, but, as the Chinese proverb goes, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. As Stanford synthetic biologist Drew Endy told NeoLife in 2018, "We want to make modelable biological systems that we understand and can use as engineers to rebuild the living world. I have to imagine that one day we'll be routinely building human genomes for any purpose that anyone can advocate for." As computing power increases and the cost of producing an entire human genome decreases, the walking pace will speed up. Lao Tzu, the purported originator of that Chinese proverb 2,500 years ago, would have needed about 300 hours to walk that 1,000 miles. Today, Lao Tzu's descendants can go 1,000 miles in 12 hours by car, 4 hours by train, 2 hours by plane, and 3.5 minutes in an orbiting spaceship. A journey of 1,000 miles still begins with a single step, but travel speeds can accelerate pretty quickly from there. The Genome Project Wright, GP Wright, one notable example of this accelerating change, seeks to raise $100 million to synthesize the full human genome, starting with synthesizing the genomes of simpler organisms, but continually moving up the complexity chain toward creating human genetic code. "What we're planning to do is far beyond CRISPR," George Church said at the time. "It's the difference between editing a book and writing one." If funded, and even minimally successful, this initiative will help scientists better understand the complex genetic and broader systems biology ecosystem. In the longer term, this understanding will help future generations manipulate, engineer, and ultimately create life. The transformation of human life into information technology will proceed apace, reading, writing, and hacking. Given these aspirations, it's no coincidence that Church's 2012 book is titled Regenesis. Our religious traditions have a three-letter word for the entity that writes the book of life. The computing, machine learning, AI, nanotechnology, biotechnology, and genetics revolutions all have different names today, but these different technologies are currents converging into one mega-revolutionary tidal wave, washing over what it means to be a human being. If we ride this wave, the only limit for how far we can go is perhaps our collective imagination. Geneticist Christopher Mason of Weill Cornell Medical College is already, for example, working on what he calls a 10-phase, 500-year plan for the survival of the human species on Earth, in space, and on other planets, and collaborating with NASA to build integrated molecular portraits of genomes, epigenomes, transcriptomes, and metagenomes for astronauts, which help establish molecular foundations and genetic defenses for long-term human space travel. The spaceship of our genetic future is already loading at the dock. That is why, when we traveled in our time machine described at the start of this book, the baby we brought back to today from 1,000 years ago was pretty much like us, but the baby we brought back from 1,000 years in the future was healthier, stronger, smarter, and more robust than most of us are today. It's also why that baby, if we feed and nurture her, will also, very likely, live significantly longer than any of us do today.